You're listening to a Mutiny Transmission.
You can find more podcasts, videos, books, comics, and records online at mutinyinfocafe.com.
Or just stop in the store in Denver and have a coffee sometime.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Queen City Companion. Give yourselves a hand for being here. I am Brian Flynn. I am one of your co-hosts this evening. Queen City Companion is an all-false storytelling show. You see people from all sorts of backgrounds trying all sorts of things, and it's always a good time and always slightly to very terrifying. So we're here to listen to everyone's creations, give everyone support, and just have a really good time. Are you up for that tonight? Yeah. Hell yeah. So my name is Brian Flynn. I am typically a stand-up comic, and the thing I am reading in the grand tradition of this show is not that. I'm not even sure what the fuck this is, frankly. I read the first part of this a couple months ago. It's from a one-act play that I'm working on. This is a sort of draft of it. And right now, I'd like to bring out our co-host, Jen Colick, to help me read it, to help me read this. Yeah, I just have the one sheet because I did not plan ahead. That could have happened off mic. I acknowledge that. And so just to get us up to speed, there are two characters in this scene. I will be playing Julia, and Jen will be playing Patrick.
Is it okay if I imagine Patrick as like the starfish from SpongeBob? Because that's usually what I do when I read this play.
That's usually what I'm imagining most of the time.
Okay, awesome.
Irregardless of the context. Cool. So Patrick is Julia's new housemate, and he has just walked in on her conducting a very strange ritual. If you want to start right here.
Do you mind if I pour myself?
Please don't.
Okay.
I need it, and it's really hard for me to get a new bottle. I have to ask my sister to buy it for me, which means I have to talk to her.
I don't get what you need it for.
I have to have a bottle of whiskey and a pack of cigarettes on the table every night before I can fall asleep.
Oh, so you're crazy.
No, I'm not crazy.
I'm sorry, that's a loaded term. Do you prefer obsessive compulsive?
I'm not obsessive compulsive.
You act like someone who is. I would know. I'm taking a psych class right now.
No, I'm not.
We haven't really talked about cures for it yet.
You can stop.
Maybe some tea? Have you ever heard of chamomile?
Look, just listen to me.
My mom is a life coach. I can get you 5% off.
I'm trying to spontaneously combust.
Fuck off.
Excuse you.
You're for real?
I am.
Oh, Jesus.
Look, if you don't want to know things like that, don't go barging in on people.
I've never talked to someone who's suicidal before.
I am not suicidal. Everyone thinks I want to kill myself. It's so obnoxious.
But you just said you want to spontaneously combust.
I'm trying to make it happen.
That's suicide.
No, it's not.
I'm supposed to call the hotline, right? I know we just met, but I'm totally willing to Google that for you.
Okay. Spontaneous human combustion is not suicide.
But it would kill you.
Yes. It would kill me. That doesn't make it suicide. Like, would you go up to a 100-year-old man and tell him, oh, stop getting old, you're gonna die?
No.
Okay, same thing. Look, suicide is direct and intentional. Someone wakes up in the morning and tells themselves they want to throw themselves in front of a train. That person is suicidal. Dying is their goal. I want to spontaneously combust. Dying is a side effect.
But it's a really big side effect.
I mean, that's relative. Dying is just a side effect of living.
Living has so many things going for it, though. There's all sorts of sights to see and odors to smell.
Are you trying to inspire me?
Is it working?
Sorry. All right, that's a little excerpt from that. That is... Holy shit, such a work in progress right now. Jesus. Give it up for Jen Colick. You'll see her again later this evening. We have so many great performers for you tonight. Are you ready for the show to start? Cool. It started already. That was a trick. Your first performer, a wonderful, wonderful stand-up comic, also a writer. She has pieces in the upcoming issue of Suspect Press. So please, please give a warm welcome to the wonderful Megan DePonto.
Everybody can do two things. I have a little short story, and then I'm also going to do a little play sketch, so I will ask for a volunteer, somebody to help out at that point. But first, I'm going to do a little, it's called I Am on the Bus. I'm on the city bus. I'm on this bus because I'm leaving somewhere and going somewhere else, but this part does not matter. The only part that matters is that I am on the bus. To my left, there's a man draped in found clothing, making a selection from his plastic bag collection of cassettes to insert into his Walkman. He's a renowned antique collector. Near the back is a gaunt woman with six hypodermic needles gouged into her flesh. They are filled with happiness, yet she is tethering her own noose. She turned to the man next to her, who has a very heated argument with his own window reflection that he keeps calling Elvis. Elvis doesn't seem to have any of the right answers today, and that makes him remarkably sad. The empty woman asked the double-occupied man for a dollar, but he had none to spare, so the noose has a new neck it shall be wrapped around. The bus screeches to an authoritative halt. Our fearless leader, the driver, has died of a heart attack. The EMTs shuffle him off, pour water on his seat until a new one sprouts up out of the worn cushion. Not one person on the bus noticed except the missionary sitting under the box of schedules, screaming hymns to the sky to pray for his lost soul. The faceless missionary hands the new driver a Bible, and he skips off the steps to the next stop. My books grows jealous of my attentions paid to the spiky-haired teenager in front of me. He's clapping his hands and singing a song no one has ever heard, as if his single objective in life was to change that. His audience is distracted by the fact that they do not care. I feel a tap on my back with a man with three teeth, nope, now two, and he tells me he likes my hair. He inquires if he can have it, and he picks up a third of his dental records off the floor. This would wear on most sane people. At the next stop, an elderly woman gets on the bus with only 78 cents to her name and hopes the kindness of strangers will generate the remaining balance. It doesn't. The young girl sniffing glue next to me asks if I want any. I drift off to a thought about how we should just park the vehicle in a suburban mall parking lot and sell tickets to peer through the windows. There's a homely couple in the very back making animal noises and taking each other's clothing off. He prematurely ejaculates, she hits him, and the buff guy next to him licks it up because he forgot his protein shake this morning. The next stop is a grocery store, and 57 people waddle on, six of which sit directly on top of me. A homeless man cuts his legs off so he can fit himself and his garbage bags filled with the commodity of his profession. My stop is approaching, so I ask the little boy at the top to pull the cord for me, but he bites it in half with his teeth and eats most of it for dinner. This is the club I belong to. All right, so we're going to... Oh, thank you. I'm going to do a little, I wrote a little sketch today. I do need a volunteer to read the other role. Would anyone be willing? Anybody want to be part of the show? It's great. Your name gets to be Sarah. Yeah, come on down. We got Sarah, everybody.
What is your name?
William.
William?
Howdy.
Pleasure. What is it?
William.
Yep. This is the table.
Cool.
I'll be reading the role of Sarah. I will read all the actions out.
Okay.
Give it up for William, everybody. That's amazing. All right. This is called The Power of Small Talk. We are inside. It is a casual restaurant. Sarah, you, and Larry, me, sit in an awkward pause on a first date. It's not going well, by the way. They've covered discussing food, and they've ordered, and the weather, and small talk has dominated the first portion of this evening, and both are becoming a wee bit itchy. If you'd like to begin.
Okay. Yeah, so...
Yep.
Listen, Larry, we could sit here and endure this awkwardness, slowly pretending about who we are, or...
We could be honest.
Yes, like, brutally honest. What's the point of dating? It's just two people slowly showing each other how gross they are.
I hate the slowly part. What if we just got out all our gross shit? Right here, right now, right on the table.
I like to shit with the door open.
I chew on pens.
I lie and say I'm into astrology so I can pretend to relate to my female friends.
I don't know if I can actually afford to pay for this dinner.
I've slept with over 100 men, most of which names I don't remember or never knew.
I'm an alcoholic.
I'm an alcoholic.
I drink to forget the time I waved to someone who was waving to someone behind me.
I drink to forget childhood summer vacation keychains my parents bought me with the name spelled wrong. It's Sarah with... You put the fucking silent H in there, and now you're just going to pretend it doesn't exist, you monsters.
My roommate bet me $200 I couldn't go 2 weeks without drinking, because if you trade a drinking addiction for a gambling one, it's not enabling.
It takes me 72 hours bare minimum after using a dish to wash it.
Who washes their dishes right after eating them? A goddamn sociopath? You don't even lie to yourself about soaking? They have to soak is what keeps us human.
Same people who finish a tube of chapstick. I've never finished a tube of chapstick. Those people who have are the only people qualified to be parents. No, not a chapstick, a pencil. If you've finished a pencil, boom, here's a baby.
I go to grocery stores and lick the frosting off cupcakes and then put them back in the boxes.
I've tasted human flesh.
I've murdered 12 hookers.
I've murdered hookers too.
Sarah, should we get out of here?
Hold on, let me suck the bone marrow out of your chicken bones.
God damn, I think I'm in love with you.
It's cold outside, you should button up.
Don't talk to me about the weather. Boom, and then he's dead. All right, thank you guys, I'm Megan Bonzo.
That was awesome, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Sure, sure, thank you.
Megan DePonso, sorry, what was your name? William? Hell yeah. Awesome. That was great. Your next performer has been on the show before. So, so glad to have him back. Please welcome the wonderful David Atkinson, everyone.
I'll just use this one instead. Are we getting sound off that? All right, can't hear. This is The Boys of Volunteer Fire 222.5 and a half. Something happened the other day that got me thinking. Is Alan Funt dead? Does anybody know? I can't remember, and it's bugging the heck out of me. You'd think I'd know that kind of thing, though I guess I don't. I swear I heard something about him passing years back, but I can't be sure. I might just be remembering thinking about it. Maybe he's just in Miami. Still, it seems like he should be dead. I mean, he was an old guy back when they did that candid camera show in the 80s. He was at least as old then as I am now, and old Billy Boy, me, was a younger guy in those days. Sure thing he's gotta be gone now. Or you never know, maybe he's still kicking. Some guys you assume must be dead and then you find out they're still hanging around someplace. Really old, not worm food like Merle Haggard. After all, you can't keep track of everybody. Some days I just count myself lucky I remembered to put pants on before leaving the house. It was those firefighter boys that got me thinking of old Alan. I hadn't been doing a whole lot before that, just flipping through a paperback tome of the most perceptive commentator on American society ever. That's right, Don Martin. Good old Phone Bone was about to offer me some insights on the U.S. ingenuity by way of a snake-in-the-can type gag when someone pounded on my front door. Now, not being the rude sort by nature, I set the wisdom of Professor Martin on the end table and went to answer it. When I opened up, though, I got knocked down and three firemen burst through the door into my living room. "Where's the fire?" the tall, bony blonde one demanded. "Where's it at?" Mind you, they didn't look much like firefighters. They had fire coats and hats and all, but that was all over blue jeans and white Fruit of the Loom t-shirts with names scrawled on it in black marker. From that, Brian was the blonde scarecrow, Wayne was a fat little long-haired kid, and Nelson was a tiny little Mexican guy. At least that's presuming they wrote their own names on their shirts. No, they certainly weren't up to any kind of classy dress. Not like me, striped collared shirt with suspenders and my best seed cap. Then again, not everyone can aspire to be on the cover of GQ. "Fire," I said. "There's no fire." The fat kid had me a mite nervous. He was swinging around this big axe. It might have looked like something from a Shakespeare in the Park set instead of a fireman's axe, but it was still an axe. "Fire could be anywhere. Wayne, locate the source. Nelson, preventatively soak the area," the blonde stick man ordered. Got it, Chief, the Mexican half-pint agreed, pulling the hose that looked suspiciously like it came from my garden. He turned on the tap and started flooding my couch. Right, Chief, the tubby kid also responded, swinging his axe above his head. Frankly, I would have been more worried about the pudge with the axe than Short Round with the water, but Tubbs tossed the axe aside and plopped down on the couch. In fact, he got comfy right under the waterfall that Pint Size was spraying. Butterball didn't play it any mind, though. He just grabbed my remote and started watching TV. I think it was the old Family Feud. Now look here, I said. But then I didn't know what to say after that. Nelson kept going with the hose, looking a bit bored, and Wayne watched TV underneath an uninterrupted flow of the cascading water. That's when I started thinking about Alan Funt. I mean, I was sure I was on candid camera. It was the only explanation. The crew just wanted me to bug out so they could get a good bit of tape for the show. I wanted to oblige if that's what was going on. They worked hard for the setup and I wouldn't want to spoil their bit. I didn't want to look like a fool, but all the prep was for nothing if I spilled the beans on camera. Still, that was only if these guys were from Candid Camera. Was that show even on the air anymore? I wasn't sure. It had been a long time since I'd seen it, but maybe it was still playing on one of them high-up cable channels I didn't get. I tried to think, but it wasn't getting me anywhere. Heck, I was pretty sure Alan Funt was dead. He probably passed on years ago. I wasn't any sure about that than anything else, but it seemed like there'd be no show if there was no Alan. But didn't they do another show just like it? I think that Kutcher kid hosted that one. Maybe I was getting pranked or whatever they called it. Though I thought that show got canned too. Maybe the Kutcher kid was dead. I'm telling you, the more I thought about it, the less I could be sure of anything. Next, I wasn't going to be sure I was alive. Clear the exits, Bony Brian bellowed, standing straight as a fence post in the middle of my living room. Check for smoke. Feel for heat spots. I don't think Nelson and Wayne were paying attention. They didn't act like it. Of course, maybe Brian wasn't shouting at them. Maybe I was supposed to do all that. He kept right on going, whether I did or not. Secure any victims in the residence. Brian grabbed me like I was a sack of russet potatoes and slung me across his back. I thought for sure he was going to crumple, but the spunky beanpole stayed up. I guess crazy adds a bit of strength. Seek higher ground to get the victim out of smoke-filled areas, he yelled, charging up the stairs to my second floor. Put me down, I managed to screech through the bumping and bouncing. If there's no path out of the smoke-filled areas, attempt to get the victim out of the house, he continued, charging back down the stairs again. I said put me down! Nelson and Wayne apparently had no interest in assisting with my rescue. Nor apparently were they going to rescue me from my rescue. They just kept there watching TV and sofa watering. If the exits are blocked, put that man down, a new authoritative voice ordered from the direction of my open front door. When I hit the floor, hard, I looked up to see a real fireman standing in the doorway. Full gear this time, real deal. Big guy too, chiseled out of granite or some such thing. His nameplate said John, but had Rusty next to it in brackets. Seemed like he might have been Korean. Now get the hell out of here! The three firemen ran frantically around my living room, hooting like they were the Three Stooges. They even ran smack into each other a few times like they were playing bumper cars on too much coffee. They ducked past Rusty and bolted outside. You okay? He asked. I suppose, I replied, using the oak banister to pull myself up. What the heck's going on? If it was Candid Camera, this would have been the moment to spring it. All he had to do was point me out where the camera was hidden. I just hoped I hadn't broken a hip. Though he didn't look much like Alan. Volunteer fire, he replied. Pardon? I saw their car and figured you might need a hand. He pointed out the door at a beat-up black and gold 79 El Camino the three Jokers had packed into. The words fire truck were spray-painted in white on the side. It always gives them away. But he held up a thickly gloved hand. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of damn fine volunteer firefighters out there serving a whole lot of communities that can't afford anything else. A lot of people would be up a creek without them. But then there's some who just live where they aren't needed and can't give up the dream. Those ones, he pointed behind him, are just trouble for everybody. Rusty tipped up the front of his hat a bit with one hand. You have my sympathy as to any damage the boys caused, but I'm afraid you won't be able to look to the department for any help. I'd have you sign a release, but they aren't affiliated. We just don't have any responsibility for them. You'd best clean up the mess yourself. He turned and walked off, but I kept looking around for Alan. I didn't expect much to see him at that point, but it would have made more sense. Does anybody know if he's still alive? I really want to know. Thank you.
David Atkinson, everyone. I'm going to try to finagle this. Oh, hey, there we go. Perfect. You've already seen your next performer this evening. She was helping me out very, very graciously. She is the host of the show, producer of the show. She has a series on Facebook Live every week that is advice for writers. She also co-hosts the Mutiny Book Club podcast, which is the last Sunday of every month. I know that. The next book is The Witch Elm by Tana French. So check that out. It's also one of our podcasts. Please, please welcome Jen Kolick.
Hey, guys. So I am I've been a fiction writer for a long time, and this is usually a show where people are getting out of their comfort zone. Usually I am doing things that I'm pretty confident about. So we're going to do something different today. I didn't know what I was going to read today until this afternoon I found this, which is the very first zine I ever made on the copier at my very first library job in March of 2009. So let's see what 23-year-old Jen was writing. there are three pieces of very, very short fiction in here. So, and none of them have titles, apparently. So we'll see what happens. Somehow I expected him to look different in the middle of the night. I'm restless on the road, only speedballing truckers, drunk teenagers, and lunatics like us out now. A familiar mixture of skunk, diesel, and shit seeps in from the turnpike, but I know it won't last long. It's a fluke, these 900 miles, and 6 months ago he never would have done it. Maybe, I think, I'm growing on him. Maybe I don't want to be responsible for anything he does. Probably I'm not. Probably we just suffer from some acute derangement, as yet undiscovered. 2 hours out, we're over the bay. Night starts coming off in layers. A semi peels by and exposes full daylight. And what's to become of us? Ragged and running from malfunctioning lives, neighborhoods, and ruins. We say it's these things, but maybe it's us. We could be anything now if we weren't always, everywhere, just exactly the same. After breakfast, he dozes to the radio. I guide us toward the horizon. The wind messes my hair, but I go faster. Listless road signs for burned-out drive-ins, the grass already dead from drought, and I wonder, what would the car sound like if we hit something? Phone pole, hitchhiker, another car. What would he sound like going against the glass? His soft muscles. Eyes straight ahead, I reach down and unclasp my seatbelt. When he wakes up, we'll be someplace else. There still won't be anything to say. That was that one. So this is number two, we'll call it. I can feel a million things moving in the grass below me. Either he doesn't notice or it doesn't bother him. I forget to ask. Look, were those pictures of J and S you were looking at before? Very serious eyes, the same color as mine. Because if you were, I mean, that's kind of fucked up, don't you think? Everyone's already upset enough. Our hair, too, is the same. His is longer. We could have been siblings instead. Some universe somewhere that I'll never even think of this one. In my head, I'm still doodling all over my sketchpad, drawing all of them, everything I can possibly remember. A tiny upturned nose, a bony wrist, a set of uneven pigtails. Flip through the stack of Polaroids, my mind is constantly snapping. Evan and his boyfriend on the couch, a terminal girl whose name I don't remember, playing piano, her hair falling to her waist. My sister. Her child. No images for these, just expressions of the others at the office. I'd thought, if I just stay here, if I act as if it's not fucking true, it won't be. The world won't just go on without me. Imagine him outlined in ink, forever leaning above me in the wide shadow of a plain concrete building. but how can I get at the feeling of his hips digging into my legs? How will I ever remember that? I'd better answer him if I ever want to get up again, so... No, of course not. They all burst out the back door just then, tumbling into our shade, all torn jackets and dirty faces. Raz, Dan Boy, Big Bird, Chucky, he sighs, and all the rest, East Coast's finest. For a second, I forget why we're all here, and none of this seems real except the ant crawling up my arm, the heavy smell of the dirt, the hips digging into my legs. And there's a picture of a cat. You guys are too far away to see it, but... Yeah, that's that one. Sorry, I usually only read the one thing. Yeah. Okay, so this is the last one. I got your letter, set it on fire, and dropped it in the toilet without even opening it. I got your letter, and after reading it, tore it up into impossibly small pieces, mashed it up for pulp to make this paper. I'm about halfway through reading your letter to everyone I know. I never got your letter. I translated your letter into Old English and left copies on every parked car from here to Exposition Avenue. I got your letter and am right at this moment packing a suitcase to fly 1,000 miles and shove it down your throat in its entirety. Your letter is resting peacefully at the bottom of the recycle bin. Times like these, I'm glad you don't have my current address. I forwarded your letter to the local paper under a fictitious name. Upon receipt of your letter, I gouged my own fucking eyes out so I'd never be tempted to read neither it nor any subsequent letters, should they be forthcoming. I photocopied your letter on a 60% scale and tucked them into various car repair manuals at the public library. I got your letter today, and clearly, it is the product of a diseased mind. I got your letter, and I'm sorry, but you must have me mistaken for someone else. Thanks, guys.
Jen Colick, everyone. Your next performer is one of my favorite people in the city and county of Denver and the surrounding Denver metro area. I need to work on my introductions. He's an absolute delight. Please welcome Zach Welch, everyone.
Hey, what's up, you guys? I hope you're ready for something very different. I don't know if... does anybody have a near encyclopedic knowledge of the second Jurassic Park movie? No. Cool. Well, as long as you're open-minded about erotica, I think we'll enjoy ourselves here. Okay, so a little bit of fan fiction. Sarah Harding died on June 13th, 1999. She was trampled by elephants attempting to gather more data to support her existing research on the social structure of stegosaurs. It turned out to be not the will or hand of John Hammond that was her demise. In fact, it was her own ego, inflated by escaping an actual trampling of stegosaurs in the Pacific Ocean and by escaping a Tyrannosaurus Rex whose baby she had taken hostage and drove through residential San Diego. She thought she could just do whatever the hell she wanted. Early on the morning of her death, in the wee hours, Sarah Harding was, as she would put it to her research partner later that morning, getting that good dick. So... her hangover wearing off as the researchers went into the savannah, she began to wonder if she had done the wrong thing. She was, after all, engaged to Dr. Ian Malcolm and had been living with him and his daughter Kelly for the last 2 years. She had hoped that the incident with the Tyrannosaurus in San Diego would make him more virile, and it did for a short time. But ultimately, his PTSD and anxiety got the better of him so much that he could not perform sexual intercourse as he could in his younger years. Her hangover subsiding, but her head still heavy with the concerns of Dr. Malcolm, she had neither the reaction time, she had neither the wherewithal to maintain a safe distance, nor the reaction time once she realized she had gotten too close to one of the baby elephants, and was eventually trampled under the weight of the herd matriarch. Dr. Ian Malcolm, of course, knew nothing of her infidelity, and was not even able to recover what remained of her for another 4 weeks. There being precious little to bury and her having no next of kin in the States, he had her cremated and dumped her ashes into the San Diego Bay, thinking, glad that's over. For you see, he too had been feeling the loss of passion in their relationship. And it wasn't that he couldn't perform. In fact, he often managed to do so successfully alone. It was just that the bond that they had forged over the events at Isla Sorna could not overcome the fact that she looked exactly like Julianne Moore. Who is a great actress, but we're not getting any younger, you know? Okay. As he stood overlooking the bay, Dr. Harding's ashes whipping around him like sea salt in the cool wind, he wondered if he would ever feel the same way he felt with Sarah the night after the Tyrannosaur was deported from San Diego. He started to think of what other times in his life he felt that kind of passion, that thrill, and he started to reflect on running through the tall grass, trying to escape the velociraptors on Isla Sorna, on outsmarting them in the workers' village, and finally escaping. He remembered the creatures being muscular, but nimble, their clawed hands swift, but exacting. How their glassy, crocodilian eyes belied the quiet, confident intelligence of an eagle. He started to think of their long, slender teeth and imagining the warm umami breath on the nape of his neck. Dr. Malcolm inhaled and realized that his pants had grown tighter. He could no longer deny his primordial prehistoric impulses. His lust was the Tyrannosaur that pulled Robert Burke from behind the waterfall with its tongue and devoured him whole. In a moment of Mesozoic machismo, Ian took a taxi to the airport and, without luggage, toiletries, or informing his teenage daughter, got on a 4 p.m. flight to Costa Rica. After spending 6 nights on the streets of San Jose, taking experimental drugs and suffering through unfulfilling sexual experiences with men and women of his own species, he found a mercenary who was willing to accept the rest of his American dollars to helicopter him into Isla Sorna. He did not shower, nor did he wash his clothes, hoping that his natural musk would attract the raptor's keen sense of smell. Once at the helipad on the park with the raptors, Ian disembarked quickly and headed into the control room. Near the desk housing the radio device that Nick Van Owen had used to save them 2 years prior, he checked his hair in a shard of glass he found on the ground. He was disheveled, to be sure, but he wanted that just rolled out of bed, sort of, I don't care about anything except getting a velociraptor deep inside of me look, you know, and that's what he was going for. He walked to the radio desk. He walked toward the radio and leaned onto the desk. Pressing his hips forward and placing his hands on the wall, he bent deeper at the waist, imagining the 1,100-pound beast firmly behind him, hissing and thrusting, gently digging its claws into his chest, his inner thigh, around his neck. His pants soon became too uncomfortable, and he knew he wouldn't be needing them for what he came here for anyway. So he hurriedly undid his belt and shrugged them to the ground before he resumed his fantasy. He continued to imagine the velociraptor's power pushing his face into the dusty wall and became so lost in his fantasy that he moaned louder and louder until he heard a crash in the next room. The raptors had heard him. A surge of blood and adrenaline filled his veins, and Ian laid flat on the table and raised his hips. The raptor, neither accustomed to the presence of humans nor with any concept of human sexuality, approached him with caution and a low growl. Confused by Ian's insistence that he just do it already, the raptor began looking and sniffing for signs of danger. Feeling relatively certain the human did not pose a physical threat and completely unaware he was being begged to do so, the raptor bent down to lick Ian's muskiest bits. Startled by Ian's ever louder screaming and puzzled as to why he wasn't running away, the raptor resumed standing upright and took a half step back. This is it, Ian thought, rising and turning around to accept a kiss from his new lover. The raptor approached slowly, clicking and purring as it muzzled its nostrils against Ian's temple. The base of Ian's spine felt weak, and his body, damp from desire and humidity, let out a low shudder. The raptor raised its head, and Ian closed his eyes, backing against the table, ready for anything. The velociraptor, still not at all sexually inspired by what was going on here, bent over and bit off Ian's extremely erect penis. Ian bled out on the communication center floor in a matter of minutes, eyes locked with the only creature he'd ever loved. The Velociraptors ate him, of course, and he was never found. His daughter, Kelly, filed a yet-unresolved missing persons report and eventually moved back in with her birth mother in Virginia. She would later lose her virginity to a furry in a Charmander costume. And the Velociraptors would go on to be notoriously horny in the third movie. Okay, that's it for me. Thanks, guys.
Hell yeah. Zach Welch, everyone. A lot of you don't realize how dead accurate a lot of that was to The Lost World Jurassic Park. That was spot on. questions at the end. We'll do do a series of drawings. Your final performance for this evening, one of them was with us just this past month. Wonderful. Helps run Denver Artists for Rent Control, and they have an event coming up January 14th, 11 a.m. at the State Capitol, which she will tell you more about. And then she has brought a special, special guest, a great musician. So please, please welcome Rosanna Frechette and E.P. Archer, everyone. I can. While they are setting up, I just want to say we have a Facebook group for this show that we try to update regularly and keep conversations going with all the people who have been on the show before, all the people who love the show. So if you are on Facebook, please join Queen City Companion on there. We do this the first Thursday of every month, which means that the next one is February 6th. Yes. February 6th. We basically have that one booked, and it's going to be amazing. So come check that out. And... Oh, yes.
I realize that I haven't seen Lost World in a long time. So mm-hmm. I remember, were there male dinosaurs?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 1, 2, and 3 were just taken from Netflix, so it was a.
That's really fun.
Perfect.
I love it. I love that we got that Q&A going on here.
Perfect. Are you all ready to go?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Rosanna Frechette.
Hey, everybody! Thank you so much for coming out tonight. It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me, Jen and Brian. Great to be back in the house. I love Mutiny Information Cafe. Let's give a big round of applause for Mutiny Information Cafe for being here. We all know that Denver's changing. It's changing really rapidly, has been. I first really noticed the sort of mushrooming of what I call irresponsible, uncontrolled growth and outrageously escalating rents, that I started to notice that back in February of 2016. And that's when I decided to found Denver Artists for Rent Control. And instead of like falling into a little pit of depression, watching my friends have to move away or losing leases, but we got creative, okay? Because we're artists. So the good side of all of that is that we've been learning to be more creative about how we share space, how we make the whole thing work, and how we band together as activists to take action. So rather than despair, take action, right? So I want to dedicate my set. Oh, and the event that Brian mentioned is the Poor People's Agenda for what we need in the next legislative Congress. And it will be meeting on the State Capitol building steps on January 14th from 11 to whenever. There will be spokespeople from all various activist groups on all the different issues of how we really need to be heard. And, you know, it's a metaphor, really. We're hardworking people in Denver, and we need to hold our ground. So I want to dedicate my set to the character of this town and all the people that make that character come alive, including everyone in the room here tonight, all the artists and activists that work really hard to hold ground for humanity, and also the offsetting of what I might refer to as an insane virus that we call Trump. So this is called Funny Business. This was no ordinary supermarket. For starters, the clerks were wearing complete clown makeup and neon bright wigs. The stock boys rode around the store pulling cartons of merchandise on little flatbeds pulled by three-wheelers lit up with Christmas sort of colored lights and festive ribbons. A steady stream of late 70s Muzak came through the speakers of a very old, rather large PA. Every 5 minutes or so, the music would suddenly stop, and one clerk or another would bark into a bad microphone some special of the day. Styrofoam veggies from Illinois. Artificial grape drink from Michigan. Hybrid rubber meat jerky from Texas. Seedy cardboard wheat bits from Nebraska. These were the day's coal train shipments from the yards of Chicago, Detroit, Houston, and Omaha. Simple fare that made good use of recyclable products. Americans were learning to digest in different ways ever since that fool Trump had brought the industry back. James Sebastian was not into any of this, and he really wished he could go back to the future. He knew that might sound trite, but he couldn't help feeling that if the way things were going was possible, I mean really, styro veggies, then something far more healthy for humans must also be possible. He had taken this job as lead clerk when his position as head monkey wrencher for Adbusters went down for the last time. He had a plan to replace the content in these boxes of cardboard crackers and such with real food. Just to see how the customers would behave. His thinking was that if people had a chance to actually process the difference without even knowing what they were eating, a real food revolution might take place. But James Sebastian was being watched by a chip in his amygdala that would track his every fight or flight move. That was the way of this thing, a world that cared only about crisis mode and had no concern for rational thinking. Saving Grace was the Neuroscientific Society of Rational Humans underground movement that had never surrendered the right to think clearly. The membership numbers were small, intentionally so, and they were slowly making progress to recover the soil of a more grounded humanity. Today, just as James Sebastian was about to pull a dozen or so boxes off the shelf, he uncharacteristically lost control of his balance and banged his right elbow so hard on the concrete ledge that a nerve pain shot through him, instantly causing an animated plastic pop-up clown to drop down from the ceiling and start yelling at him not to try any funny business. At first, this seemed like it would derail the day's effort. But it turned out the nerve pain was coming from James' funny bone, and so caused him to begin laughing and crying at once. This, the lead clerk's lack of human control or resistance, satisfied the clown, which deflated to the size of a small parachute, and then shot itself back to the painted black, tempered glass ceiling. Thank you. So now I'm going to invite the wonderful musician, E.P. Archer, to come up and accompany me with her violin. That's what we decided on for tonight. That would be fun for the next two little pieces. I'm a cross-genre writer, and so sometimes I weave poetry into my sets that have flash fiction. Other times I have vignettes. And largely tonight, well, tonight this is all invented. This is all made up stuff for Queen City Companion. Based on our experiences of real life, I'm dedicating these two pieces, with the help of EP, to the Pope's recent trip to Ireland and all the Catholic school children of the world. Fair game. Playing said game by myself. See how long before checkmate sets in. I move pawns, fresh abandon. So many, all young, move precisely in loops, prolonged game. Bishop sits idly by, awaiting perusal. Strong, silent strength, while old castle yawns into the power of stalemate. Comes the day when said unforeseen earthquake, the day when said unforeseen earthquake will shake everything in the house, shake everything in the house, marble chessboard included, now bishops and castles and pawns of unbelievable moments collide with what cannot be. Sure force, destroy everything, every piece, every bit. Sure force, destroy everything, every piece, every bit. Everything, every piece, every bit. Everything, every piece, every bit. We call game. Head of a pin. Angels can dance on the head of a pin. Perhaps as many as priests that dare to dance on the point of a very sharp needle. When a man of the black and white collar pulls your head into his lap, your 9-year-old mind wonders what sort of priests are next to God-like thing he is doing. You're confused, but he's not. And he makes this very wrong action seem like divine order while no one is looking. You tense up like a threatened kitten and wonder if this is some strange penance for that last false confession you made. It was a lie you invented when you couldn't think of any real sins. 4 Hail Marys and 1 Our Father, plus an hour of raking leaves at the rectory, seemed fair enough for the sin of a big lie made up while you knelt on a hard confessional bench. You nervously breathed warm smell of old wood as the unforgiving odor of stale cigar came at you from behind a dark screen. One week later, your head is in his lap on a ride home from the rectory, and you are reeling with confusion you will never speak of, a new sin, one that does not belong to you. Now, so many years later, You wake long before the alarm with a sensory memory of fresh fallen leaves and the familiar knot of how things right become wrong. You are thinking of angels dancing on the head of a pin when the knot dissolves. You are feeling the knot dissolve into pure light. It is unexpected, this feeling of grace, this sense of wrong things losing power. And you find yourself laughing at 5 a.m. while thinking of ridiculous priests all decked out in devil red robes, stuck in a strange kind of time warp, exhausted while dancing together on the point of a very sharp needle. That was EP Archer. She just released a CD in July. You can talk to her about that after the show. We're delighted that we met at the Mercury Cafe for the Jam Before the Slam, which I co-host frequently. It's poetry and improv music. We love what we do. We love Denver, right? Arts and culture. This place rocks, and we got to keep it rocking by taking action. Whatever you care about, whatever you feel passionate about, just make sure that you pay attention. What's going on? What's coming down the pike? What's going up? And just pay attention. Call your legislators. Go to city council meetings. Whatever you can do. Write to the press. Write a column, do something, but take action and never give up. That's the thing. Never give up. So anyway, to make myself feel better, on the day that President Trump took office, well, the day that we found out he would be taking office, I wrote this, and it takes place in Marfa, Texas. Has anyone here heard of Marfa, Texas? Yeah. So, you know, it's a wonderful little town somewhere in the desert of Texas, and it is, it's historic. It's been a county seat for a long, long time. I imagine pioneers coming through on horseback and stopping there at the saloons, a watering hole. But now it is an art colony living there of sort of rebel liberal artists doing installation art. And it's kind of getting a name for itself now. I don't know what's going to happen with that. But it's sort of like we have a little expat place there in Marfa, Texas, right here in our own country, of artists that have gone somewhere to just do what they do and be a little, I don't know, set apart in that. Anyway, this takes place in Marfa, Texas. This will be my final piece for you. It's called Speech. It was the year 2024, and the usual standard of presidential terms had fizzled out over the last few elections. The earthquake madness of a Trump administration had leveled it all, and things could not ever be handled the same. Good thing. Of course, the United States population had nearly halved itself over that one, with a good many Americans fleeing to other more sane nations. Today, Jane Liberty Adams took the orator pulpit at the town square in Marfa, Texas. Oddly enough, Marfa was now the capital of a free nation, for which this election had neither been dual party nor televised. Dressed in denim and boots, the president-elect had just gotten off of her horse and was ready to deliver her message. Ms. Adams was deaf and dumb, and had been deemed the most intelligent, progressive candidate to come along since JFK, and the most compassionately sincere since Jimmy Carter. Her smile was honest and grand as she took one step up to no microphone and began signing slowly and clearly. These words from her acceptance speech would become among the most quoted ever. Words are not the answer. Only pure action is appropriate now. There is nothing more to say. Thank you for listening. It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Rosanna Frechette and E.P. Archer. One more time, everyone. And thank you to everyone who's gone up tonight. One more time for everyone you've seen. For Mutiny Information Cafe. For Jen Kolick. Host, producer. Like I said, we will be back the first Thursday in February. And real quick, we do take donations to give to the performers. So if you have anything extra you would like to throw in, please do. It is so welcome. Thank you so much for coming, and we'll see you next month.
Mutiny Transmissions is a media service that provides podcasts, video, and live shows recorded inside and outside of Mutiny Information Cafe, located at 2 South Broadway in Denver, Colorado.